victim's got his blanket.
Yes. hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. Hello, chaps. I hope you have had an interesting and stimulating week. I'm not drinking today because I drank yesterday with my Scottish friend. I'm on Cocta. I've finally cracked open the very, very rare but wonderful Yugoslavian drink that is Cocta, and that's what I'm on tonight. But I don't know what Paul's on or what Lipton's on. But anyway, so cheers, everybody. Hurligan, Gurligan, Capis, Saludo, Bruce, Prost,
Scrub your nan,
Yakidar, Slanger, and Slangervar. And welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are. Oh, have I missed anything out? I don't think so. Turby sexy and whatever the Russian thing is. And cheers. Khudavon. Yeah, Khudavon.
Zrobia.
Zrobia. Khudavon, Mania. Hard Mania. I hope the door is good. Yeah, Dax in the class, yeah. Zvata Pete. Cheers, everybody, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, on my public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss interesting stuff on psychology and academia and the kind of research that's expunged from our woke joke universities, and also try to just have a bit of a laugh and you know, as it were, chat shit, which is a problem for some people. We have a very special guest for you today, and that is Paula Wright, and who I've interviewed for my channel. It will go up at some point. It's not been published yet. I'd like Paula to introduce herself. So, Paula, tell them a bit about yourself.
I'm a evolutionary psychologist, and I'm sexier than sexist on X, and I'm a feminist critic.
Okay, well, there you go. She's also quite interesting in the sense that you may have heard of Thomas Edward, the Aberdeenshire shoemaker. He was a shoemaker in the 19th century who was a world expert on mollusks. Paula has published widely in evolutionary psychology. She's published in top journals with interesting people and all kinds of stuff, and she's a cleaner. So I personally find that, with all the credentialism you get these days, all the sort of Adam Rutherford, oh, how can you comment on something you haven't got a doctorate in? I find that quite interesting. So, you've gone quiet. You've gone silent. I knew this would happen. This happened on the record interview as well. Paula crashed and went silent and things like this. So I'll just carry on until she sorts that out. The microphone's off. Have I got it off? Hang on. Unmute mine. You can't unmute because your guest has chosen to mute themselves. Right, that's what it says. Oh, you have. But we'll hopefully get. Okay. Don't do that again. Good.
I promise, right, Ed, not to make any comments about women and technology whatsoever. I will not do that.
Don't make any comments about women.
I won't.
Not to make a single one. All right, so cheers, everybody, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. Paul is indeed back now. What's been appertaining? So, well, it's quite an interesting story. Like, Paula, would you mind perhaps telling the Assemble how it is you went from being a County Durham lass to getting involved in the depths of academia?
I'm from a working class mining village in the East Durham coalfield, and I left school without any qualifications for various reasons. Got a recommendation from the careers advisor to get a job on the cheese counter in Tesco's. But I didn't want to do that. So for about 10 years, I became an actress, a professional actress. And then at 30, because I didn't have any qualifications, I got interested in evolutionary psychology. So I did a kind of Mickey Mouse degree in art history in Newcastle. And they were teaching a lot of Marxism and feminism on that. And I learned a lot enough to criticize Marxism and feminism. And my dissertation was an attempt to a consilience between feminism and evolutionary psychology. They weren't interested in a consilience. So after that, I had a baby, and I basically just contacted lots of evolutionary psychologists. Was mentored by Darwinian philosopher Helena Cronin, evolutionary psychologist Daniel Nettle, and pioneer in female intersexual competition, Anne Campbell at Durham University. All of this just as an independent. Then I developed a online salon called Darwinian Gender Studies, which by that time I wasn't a feminist at all. But this was kind of preempting the kind of culture war and the way that kind of sex and gender would be merged and the problems that would come up from that. In 2008, I created that, and then David Buss joined, and Robert Trivers joined, and lots of people joined, and for about 10 years, and Claire Lemon joined. Yeah, it was a really good, very exciting intellectual salon. And then the culture war hit in about 2014. Yeah, and then I started writing. And obviously I'd been co-authoring papers as an independent during that time.
Yes, yes. This is how I discovered you. And how would you? Our friend Paul here used to put on the bottom of the screen, "Ed is a crass Darwinian," and I was told by David Starkey that I was engaging in crass Darwinism. So what you're saying, consilience. The idea is what you're basically reducing everything to Darwinism.
No, E.O. Wilson's kind of idea of consilience was the consilience of the natural and the social sciences. So that's kind of psychology.
Can I just clarify, by consilience, yeah, do you mean reduction?
No, I mean the joining.
In the sense that anything that's not totally purely science will be reduced to a scientific outlook, and you use the word consilience rather than use the word reduction.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, I just saw it got our terms clear, because I'm used to talking to Ed.
That's the unity of knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, the unity of knowledge, yeah.
By the exclusion of other types of knowledge.
Sorry?
By the exclusion of other types of knowledge.
Does it include that?
I get suspicious when the jargonistic words like consilience are used.
Well, it's just a book. It's just what E.O. Wilson's book is called, Consilience.
But why? It's a neologism, isn't it?
Well, whatever it is, it's just, you know, the idea of unifying the sciences and bringing... You know, that was my idea at university, to kind of like try and steelman feminism, bring it into a much more kind of empirical
Okay. I think this is going to happen quite a lot, which is unfortunate, because it has. It's happened. Oh, it's happened. I can't believe it. Okay, let's just... Well, hopefully she'll come back. This is exactly what happened when I interviewed Paula on the recording, sort of not live. Her computer just kept crashing.
Lecky bill not being paid?
It's very hard to say, but it just kept happening, and so I had the interview planned for an hour, and in the end it went on for an hour and a half because I had to take into account the number of times that the computer just crashed. Let's move back to that later. Now, what's going on then in the news, chaps? That's what we normally focus on at this point in the show.
Oh, Ed, sorry to interrupt you, but could you please do, you could fill in the time when Paul is not on by formally apologising to the Sammy people.
For what? Sorry, we've got...
Oh, sorry, am I more up to date with Finnish news than you are?
What's happened to the Sammy people?
The Finnish government's had some truth and reconciliation investigation type thing, and they've admitted that there have been decades of abuse of the Sami people, and the Prime Minister of Finland has apologised, and it's all been a big thing in Finland.
I haven't heard about this. Sorry
for reading about it in the British press.
I haven't read about it. I haven't seen it in the British press. All I've seen in the Telegraph today is some woman in England dressed in Sami costume who has a reindeer farm.
So can I clarify? You're so racist, you won't even pay attention to the Sami people when they're in the news.
I bother to check the Wiley news in English occasionally, and sometimes I have a read of Ilta Sanomat in Finnish. But I have to confess that I didn't know they'd done that. But I suppose that... Yeah, I mean, one of the things they would do, of course, is take them to boarding schools. We can talk. I mean, that's one of the things because these people live so remotely, you know, that you can't really do anything other than have them at boarding schools. And as has widely been revealed in England over the last few centuries, boarding school, and particularly since the 50s when we started seeing it as unacceptable, boarding schools seem to attract less than entirely wonderful people, don't they?
And the teaching staff, you mean?
The teaching staff, yeah, they tend to attract. Obviously, if you've got people that are predatory with regards to children, then getting a job at a boarding school is probably quite a good idea.
How many jobs did you get turned down for at boarding school then?
I was turned down because, yeah, exactly. You're quite right, Paul. I wasn't predatory enough. There were the paedophilia exams, the very rigorous paedophilia exams, which you have to take if you want to teach at an English boarding school. I kept failing them. The theory test was okay, but it was that practical test. You just couldn't quite pass it. So it's not something I experienced. Did you ever apply for teaching jobs or anything like in secondary education? Was it always tertiary?
Oh, I hate teenagers more than I hate younger children.
Interestingly, I haven't received it as yet, but I became really interested in executive and professional coaching.
Yeah.
So that's something that I've been looking into quite a bit, like literally doing courses, meeting people. I could see myself as a professional coach. Well, I'm already a professional coach in a sense, but I don't have a lot of clients, but I do talk to people.
I think you'd be great, Lipton, at blanket studies.
Blanket studies.
You'd be too right-wing, though, Lipton, because as the news item that I led on today, which says a great deal about what's going on, we have a situation where a guy called Jamie Michael, 47, a former Royal Marine from Penygraig in South Wales, was found not guilty of incitement to racial hatred after 17 minutes during the Southport. Do I mean Southport? No. Is it Southport or the other one? I always confuse these two places. During the trial with regard to Axel Rudakabana, he was found not guilty. But he's been thrown off. He can't now supervise an under-15s girls football team, which includes his daughter, on the basis of this, even though he was found not guilty. And what they're basically arguing is that based on the views he's expressed, he's a bit racist because he's called illegal migrants scumbags and psychopaths. That's what he said.
Let me give you an example. So I was speaking to this lady, and she's a lovely lady, quite liberal, and she said to me she has an issue with illegal immigrants who rape. She finds them scary. And I know this other lady who is also quite lovely, and she thinks that immigrants, if they come here, they should work. It doesn't matter if they're refugees or asylum seeker or if they're legal or illegal, they should just work. So a lot of people personally are not in favor of negative immigration. But they won't say it in public.
If they state that in public, then you get a situation where the Cwm Taft Morgannwg, have you heard of these places, Paul? The Cwm Taft Morgannwg.
I think that's a pretty accurate pronunciation, though, Ed. I'm pretty confident.
Thank you very much. It's CWM, Cwm.
To be grammatically correct, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but to be grammatically correct, you have to add look you boyo at the end of it.
Sorry, the Cwm Taft Morgannwg, look you boyo. okay, lovely boys. Just make you soldiers of you, lovely boys. Then you have to do that. And they have declared that basically on the basis of expressing a right, they've said, there should be no politics in sport. And apparently during the hearing, this guy, Jamie Michael, said to them, well, if there's no politics in sport, why do you have to kneel before football matches? Why do you have to take the knee? And they quickly diverted away from that issue. And he's been banned from supervising an under-15s football team, basically on the grounds that he's expressed negative views in admittedly quite emotional terms about immigration. So he's banned.
It'll only get better, though, you know, when there's the equivalent in legal terms of the Free Speech Union. If there were local authorities and various institutions having their arses sued off them, and, you know, legal fare used against them, law fare, then I think that would help rectify things quite a bit.
Yes, but presumably the legal profession is now very, very strongly infested with left-wing types.
They would sell their own grandmothers to earn a few quid. So there's always that aspect.
Yes, that's true. So basically there has to be sort of a tipping point. And then
you need a few billionaires to fund lawfare and to take local authorities and anyone who's doing this type of thing and sue them to within an inch of their lives.
Well, this is what's currently happening with this guy, Michael. So once we now have a trade union, a free speech trade union, which is one of the good things that Toby Young has done. Mm. Toby Young has managed to set up. And I suppose, like any trade union, if it reaches a critical mass, then it has a power. I mean, I don't remember, but in the 70s, I suppose the power that trade unions have, that they can wield. Once they're allowed, and once they're allowed in various professions, and then you're off, and they can do all kinds of stuff to favour their pet political causes. And we have them shutting down the railways every so often, and so on. So as long as they have the money behind them to keep going, I'm a member of the Free Speech Union, even though I don't live in the UK.
It's going very strong. It's doing great work. But my point is, it takes legal things on reactively. But its nature is not that it's supposed to sue people for doing things like you're describing, which is what I'm suggesting would be a further development.
Yes, but at the moment, it's not hit far enough. It's not clicked over. It's not fallen over into a critical mass.
But it's not. That's also not its remit. Its remit is to protect free speech. Its remit isn't to proactively sue the arse off people. So I'm suggesting we have to find a way to do that next step.
Yes, a legal union that whose purpose is to sue the arse off people.
I just wish Elon Musk could dip in his pocket and just fund billions and billions of dollars of lawfare against institutions.
Yes, imagine. And again,
that's possible in the States.
No, but he could do it here. He could just pay a load of lawyers.
America all the time.
Sorry,
the DEI edifice in America. It was dismantled by right-wing activists.
Kind of. But there was the money. There's the knowing you've got money behind it. That's the thing. Hello, Paula. You're back.
I am. Have you heard of the Westminster Declaration?
What's this, then? Tell us.
This is... I'm just getting it up here. It is... The open discourse is the pillar of free society... We write as journalists, artists, authors, activists, technologists, and academics to warn of the increasing international censorship. So it's kind of a bunch of tech guys, including, let me see, Matt Taibbi. Where is it? God, come on. There's a few English guys in there. Andrew, who's the Comedy Unleashed guy?
I don't. I know what you mean. Yeah.
They're getting together. Matt Taibbi, Michael Schellenberger, John Haidt, John McWhorter, Steven Pinker, Julian Assange, Tim Robbins. So they've signed this declaration. It's called the Westminster Declaration because it was signed in Westminster last year or the year before. And it's about kind of coming up with non-work terms, terms and conditions.
I was enjoying that. Now, Lipton, careful what you say here, because I don't want to use any forbidden words. But I was enjoying that till you used the term Steven Pinker.
Yeah, no, he's kind of
because he has got
a shadow.
he has just come out in a new book that argues in detail that certain academic topics that we will not mention on here, Lipton, but certain academic topics, and you all know what they are.
Yeah.
Should be basically just not discussed. Should just be not discussed.
Yeah.
He's just said that. And
and they agree.
They're all a bit woke now, all the old intellectuals. We need a kind of a few more funerals.
The people, some are saying Pink is hit and miss. These are people that are coming out saying we are in favour of free speech. We want all of these things. We are in favour of free speech. And they don't. They don't. That Westminster, whatever it was you said, Declaration, that is exactly the problem. That is a bunch of people who believe in free speech, but not that free speech. Or not that free, not there, and not him, and not on that subject.
Yeah.
And that's what we've got. These people are the enemy.
Well, you see what's happened today with all of the suddenly all of the right or the centrists who call themselves right are kind of like accusing Nick Fuentes of being funded by Russian bots. Kind of the Russia argument is now being used against Fuentes because he's more populist since he went on Tucker.
No, personally, I think that mainstream right-wingers like Nick Fuentes because he's controlled opposition. If you promote Nick Fuentes as the face of the right, you discredit a lot of people.
How is Nick Fuentes controlled opposition?
He's not controlled opposition. I don't know if he's being paid. So he's not controlled opposition in the sense that he's being paid or directly controlled, but he's controlled opposition in the sense that Nick Fuentes will only go so far.
Nick Fuentes will only go so far.
Yeah, let me give a perfect example. Like, he was profiled by the New York Times and he said, look, I don't know much about the Holocaust. Like, as I have written in a piece, there is no Nick Fuentes to Ron Hunt's pipeline or to Richard Lynn pipeline. Nobody listens to Nick Fuentes and says, oh, I'm going to read Counter Currents. So he doesn't. Nick Fuentes is a mass leader. So the people who follow Nick Fuentes are basically loser men. nobody's going to listen to Nick Fuentes and buy 10 Richard Lynn books. Nobody does that. And that's why he's so popular, because Nick Fuentes is articulate, he's not dumb, but he's not serious.
He can be serious, though. When I had him on my show, he was very serious and very intelligent. And it was weird because I was thinking what I'd seen of him, you know, of course he was famous, so I wanted to have him on. But what I'd seen of him was just all this joking around and laughing around and all this, you know, and just having a laugh, basically, and just saying outrageous things, just to say outrageous things.
But Ed, you bring out the serious in people.
You looked a bit shocked.
In the video.
Yeah,
I was shocked. Because I was expecting him to just sort of make me laugh for an hour and a half. That was what I was anticipating.
Well, he's been a half edgelord, half, you know, quite serious politician. I've been watching him since the Tucker interview, and I'm actually really impressed. He's not an anti-Semite. He's not racist. He's not. In fact, I was doing
Paula, did you call him an edgelord?
He's kind of half edgelord.
I thought that was something different. Sorry.
All right, sorry.
What is an edgelord?
Just somebody who makes jokes for the sake of it. Like, you'll see the N-word just because to push the Overton window, just because he was sick of being like held hostage by words. You know, when Tucker was trying to get Piers Morgan to say, faggot, 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 faggot. Well, it's like, come on, Tucker, say the N-word.
By which she's talking about the bits of wood that were used to burn people at the stake in the
1950s.
Faggots, yes. Yeah,
meatballs. Meatballs with gravy.
They were meatballs. That's what they were always called. I didn't know where that word. And that word was never an English word as well. I was amazed by this watching the news.
What, meatballs?
Yeah, faggots with meatballs. Meatballs. When I was a kid, that's what faggots were. Meatballs. I guess so. I don't know. But I remember seeing them in the supermarket in about 1986 in Carrefours in Winchester, and saying to my grandmother, what are they? And she said, they're meatballs.
I saw some in a car park too.
In the car park of that supermarket. That can happen. That's when words have three meanings rather than one. But yeah.
At two in the morning.
Indeed, through a steamed up windscreen of your car. it is ridiculous. The being held hostage by words. The idea that I know on here, there's certain words we're not allowed to say. They are magic words, and the view is that the sky will fall in, and there was a sense of that in. I suppose it must have been like in the 50s with Puck or whatever, which we can now just say with impunity.
Well, can I make another suggestion? It always winds me up. I've got no, flag to wave for Nick Fuentes or people like him. But I just wish that when leftists are on various formats, they should be called Maoists or Stalinists, and they should be named for what they are. It all seems there's an asymmetric naming that anything on the right wing or any certain words are verboten, but it's never applied to the left. And I would insist in various interviews on certain words being forbidden, because they're just like anything to do with Mao should be forbidden because it's horrendous. And just try, you know, flip it onto the other side. Why is it always asymmetrically on one side?
Well, that's kind of what Nick's problem is. It's kind of, you know, certain communities in America, you know, the Somali, like and Omar, whatever her name is, can say, or people can write books about, you know, black people shouldn't be living near white people. You should separate yourself. You know, exactly. Black separatism. And he's saying, well, why can't we say that? If it's wrong, then it's wrong for everybody. If it's right, then we can should be able to say it. So that's kind of his edgelordy kind of thing. And I think there's a generational gap between him pushing that envelope there, and boomers and Gen X and even some millennials just going, oh, you can't say that, you know, when it can, but it's actually...
Yeah, but Paul, I'm saying something slightly different. I'm saying push it, take what they're doing, the wokies, take what they're doing and push it back at them using their own logic. So I refuse to let you mention Mao because that is horrendous.
They pretend they don't understand logic.
It's like Hassan Piker.
Well, fine, but I'm saying there are ways of interrupting interviews and stuff. There are ways of calling out people like Fiona Bruce for being completely asymmetric in the way she treats people. And my frustration is people in these formats don't hold people to account. They play to the rules that they've been given rather than, messing things up a bit.
I would say kind of trigonometry is more controlled opposition. People like that. They stick to a really kind of very simple, sensible issues, you know, like trans, like women are women, of course, and stuff like that. But then when it comes to somebody like Nick Fuentes, now they're thinking about getting him on. But before, he was verboten before. But now
they want Nick Fuentes on now?
Mm-hmm.
Do they want him?
They want him to come on. They're saying that he's avoiding them, but actually I watched Nick's response to that, and he said, you know, I'll be doing them a favor, you know, my show does better than theirs.
That is such cowardice though. So to watch him basically be slightly laundered by virtue of having gone on a show as big as Tucker Carlson, and then and only then say, we'll have him on, aren't we edgy, aren't we brave?
Well, that's what Piers Morgan's doing tonight as well. He's having him on.
What? Utter cowardice.
And that's why I can't take the mainstream media seriously. Nick Fuentes is being interviewed by mainstream people, and a few minutes ago they did not want to talk to him. There's no consistency with these people.
Well, no, they're power. They're motivated fundamentally by, I call it bravery signalling, as a term I think.
The same people don't want to speak to Ed either.
No, there are.
That's
totally understandable.
Paula, personally, I think I'm the bravest man online.
Under a blanket, Lipton.
No, seriously. I interviewed Jared Taylor.
I don't know who that is. I don't know who that is. I haven't been Jareded.
Okay. Yeah. I interviewed like almost everybody on the far right. I interviewed Ed.
That's the extreme right.
Jared Taylor.
I interviewed Jordan Lasker.
Oh, I'm really out of the loop on the far right.
So did I. Taylor is a white identity politics advocate, so he's quite but he's also intelligent and articulate.
Yeah,
so
you do listen.
The left to have to deal with. But yeah, I didn't know that. But that's how it works, though. We're living through the process of a right wing backlash, and as that right wing backlash happens, that's exactly what happens as you shift, and it can happen quite quickly. That's what I argued in my book. The past, there's research on this in psychology. You know, once 20% tipping point.
You know the Baptist and bootlegger paradigm.
I think you mentioned it to me. But...
Political economy. Well, you go ahead.
Go
ahead, because I like economics. That's Baptist and bootlegger.
Oh, well, it's you can probably explain it better than me, because I've only just looked at Wikipedia. But it happened. What's the time in America where they banned alcohol?
Yeah, 20s.
So they banned alcohol and prohibition, the prohibition area, and it was kind of Elliot Ness and all that kind of thing. And so they banned. They found a way just for the Baptists and the bootleggers to make money from the same thing. They're both making money. They're both exploiting the system. And neither of them have an interest in actually solving the problem. That's how I see kind of a lot of stuff today in media.
Personally, Paula, I think that anti-wokeism is a political economy problem. Wokeism it's profitable for right-wing grifters who would like to see that they're anti-woke. If woke people do not exist, they don't have people to criticize. Exactly. Therefore, they become ineffective. Like that, so they thrive on the exterior of wokeism.
Lipton, yeah. You do know that Ed's alongside you while you're saying all this.
Oh, come on.
The grifter Ed, he's yeah, always writing books.
You could at least talk behind your hand, Lipton.
I do know. I am aware. I'll accept this. I am aware in terms of the economics of things. If you use the word woke, perhaps this will decreasingly be the case. But if you use the word woke, then people are interested. That's true. So obviously, if I give a book a title, Woke Eugenics, intuitively is a contradictory title because all the eugenics is the far right, woke is the far left, whatever. That is a title people sit up and listen to. Oh, what's that? That's interesting, right? Whereas if I just called it something like left wing eugenics, it wouldn't work as well. There's something about that word. Why is it taken? Also, beyond the what you call grifting notion of it, there's something about that word as well. I wonder what it is, what people's thoughts are on this, that it's taken off. It's way more than social justice warrior, which we used to call
it. It's four letters and people are illiterate and thick these days.
It's a good meme. It's a meme.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point.
So it's a short word. You can say it in one syllable, yeah. Woke.
Woke.
And it means intersectionality. Which is not a good meme. Woke is intersectionality, basically, in all kind of areas of institutions. But woke, yeah.
It just hits woke, in. So it's so simple. And so this it's simple. It's beautiful.
It's like a literate Tourette's, isn't it? Woke.
Yeah.
It's just a substitute for biscuit.
Yeah, biscuit has too many syllables.
Can you say feck?
Feck.
I once saw a documentary about a girl that had a woman. She was a black girl, and she had Tourette's syndrome. But she was also from a very religious background to such an extent that she couldn't bring herself to swear, which is what they normally do. So she would do things like she was just walking on. Yeah, so I think we should go into Marks and Spencer's and get Thundercats, and get one of the sandwiches, and then Thundercats. Yeah. That's what she'd do, and various other things like that as well, like children's programs. And just
I don't believe in it though. I think it's like dyslexia. I think it's made up.
Dyslexia doesn't seem to be made up. It's not made up.
You've gone woke as well, Ed.
How is dyslexia woke? It's overdiagnosed.
Well, 20, 30 years ago, it was you're a bit thick and you can't read very well.
That's why I didn't get any qualifications at school.
No, but Paul, some university students are identifying as disabled to claim benefits. Especially
I've tried. I'm not that disabled.
Well, I'm athletically dyslexic, but I've never asked for a 20-second head start in a 100-meter race.
Never. I was called spastic, and it was technically true. And every year at sports day, it would be me being last in some inconsequential race, such as the sack race or whatever.
Did you make it a bit? Did you make it a bit?
I don't know what that means.
Did you make it into a comedy routine?
Oh, no, I didn't. No, I earnestly tried to win and didn't. And then and you'd have that local mum said, oh, it don't matter. Oh, it's taking part that matters. Oh, Ed,
didn't you have an advantage on the three-legged race? Because it was your natural gait.
I don't think I ever participated in that. But yeah,
you should have done. You would have been a ringer. You'd have won.
I didn't occur to me. But then in the first year of secondary school, I just refused. I just point blank refused. I had that confidence that came with your mum being a teacher, so they can't really put you in trouble. My mum was a teacher at my secondary school. So I just refused.
And that's when the rot started. You cannot now complain about the woke being trans, you know, on the rise when you benefited from that type of attitude.
Well, no, the attitude at the time was that absolutely you must go in a race.
Exactly. You should have been made to go on 10-mile runs every bloody day until you got better.
Oh well, that was quite good though, because we did cross country running at school, obviously, and me and my little group of friends we'd look behind us and there'd always be like the three fatty kids distantly shimmering on the horizon. Like, you know, we were never last. that shame did not occur. You know, we were third from last at worst, because they'd be all the way over there.
Stopping off for donuts.
Yeah, like just stopping off for a little rest, the wee.
Yeah. One of them was Ricky Gervais.
Probably, yeah. I don't know. I guess that was kind of reassuring. You know how you can say to yourself, "Oh, there's always someone older than you." Unless you're the oldest person in the world, there's always someone's worse at PE than you. That even though you're born 3 months early and you're basically a cripple, there's these people on the horizon that just can't stop eating. And oh god, it was good.
Where your "born too soon" thesis comes from?
I wonder what the idea of what the "I'm born early, I'm a genius, therefore I see what you mean." It was why I became interested in it. Yeah, I think I just read somewhere in some article, some not very good article in the Telegraph, that a number of geniuses were born prematurely, and I looked into it. And at first, I did a paper refuting it. I said, "No, this is bollocks. This is not the case." But then I looked into it more. And properly and in detail for the book, like beyond what they said in the Telegraph. I just refused what they said in the Telegraph was wrong. I looked into more people, more scientists, more people than they mentioned, and they were born prematurely. And then you realize there is a relationship between they're elevated, statistically significantly elevated among accepted scientific geniuses, and there's quite a lot of them among. So oh, she's gone again. Among charismatic types as well, that they say are born early, but part of that could just be to give them an interesting birth because they're, you know, God on earth or whatever. I don't know what it is about your computer, Paula. But there was that as well, that you get like all these charismatic types, like Moses in Jewish tradition was born 3 months early. Buddha.
Ed, I'm assuming you were a forceps delivery, yeah?
But obviously not, because I was born 3 months early.
Yeah, but they're allowed to use forceps, I reckon.
I don't think they'd have used forceps. Forceps is normally if it's the child is too big, isn't it? If the child is big, a big head, if the mother is having trouble giving birth to this big child.
I apologise. Then your skull must be shaped that reason, that you know that way for a different reason. Sorry.
It's the Habsburg chin, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's Habsburg chin. Come on, we don't know what kind of chin Paul has because he covers it up with Jerry Adams beard. But that is Harold Shipman beard. So I think this is
here every week.
Sorry,
yeah, we'll welcome every week.
We are every week.
We might
hello.
It may get to that eventually. Yes, but it gives it a bit. I must say, Paul and I may have crossed over in Durham.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I sent her photographs of me when I was at Durham, and she noted that I looked like somebody from something called Depeche. I don't know what that means, but I assume it's a compliment.
Depeche Mode.
What's that, then?
It's
a group in the 80s.
Hmm.
Yeah, he was there in the 90s, weren't you, though? Because I'm older than
99.
I said, you look like a cute goth.
Yes, it was felt that I could have been her toy boy had we crossed over, but it didn't.
No, you knew
it. It didn't happen, unfortunately. It never. Well, we didn't really talk to the locals very much, as I said.
No.
Unless they were our cleaners. And if you're watching my cleaner at Hilfe College, Liz, hello, Liz. I hope all's going well. You're welcome. Oh, thank you for cleaning my room, Liz. You're welcome.
Psychologically, you can tell a lot about people from being a cleaner. You know, you can tell, you know, how they treat people who they feel are below them in status. Because, I mean, obviously, I don't tell anybody, I don't even tell the place I work what I do because I'd be sacked. Because everything's woke now. The high street shops are woke. Everything is woke. I used to work in the NHS. I got out of that because it was a nightmare. And then I was a lifeguard for a while. Great kind of thing, just being able to work by myself. But I couldn't listen to books. Obviously, you have to pay attention to the people in the
pool. Sorry to interrupt, Paula, but someone in the comments said, I bet Paul is imperious with his cleaner. I am very polite to my wife, Aragon. So bugger off.
Imperious.
Anyway, sorry, Paula, go on.
So I was a lifeguard, but you can't, yeah. So now being a cleaner, I can actually listen to all my audiobooks while I don't only work 2 hours a day and I get paid more than I did in the NHS. and I work by myself. I don't have to put up with any office politics. I don't have to put up with shit middle managers or any kind of office bullying. It's, yeah, great.
It's sounding a bit tism, Paul.
But look at Paula's host. Paula, your host looks nice. The background.
I can see dust.
I only clean when I get paid for it.
No. You know what I find?
It's really like hairdressers always have shit haircuts.
Oh,
well, you have a little dog. You have a dog. You sleep.
I do. She's a husky.
Yes.
Oh, what's his name?
She hasn't got a top collar on. She's called, which one is it? Because I've got an old one upstairs. That's Suki.
Suki. Sounds like a Japanese prostitute.
No, it's the Japanese moon goddess.
Actually. Says the man wearing a kimono.
You what?
Says the man wearing a kimono.
I have never been to Japan. I've often thought I'd like to, but I have never been to Japan. But there we go. Hello, Slanger, local back and Slanger. There you are. Good to see you. I don't know where you've been. You've been late. We have a new guest on. A new guest. This is Paula Rice. You'll get to know her. Where were we? Yeah, the one thing that I object to about sports there. We've moved off the serious topic a bit, but we move back onto it. In the second half, is that all of the badly behaved yobby kids at school, the kind of people that in 1995, when I was 14, and our form tutor said, what do you want to do for a job when you grow up? And one third of the class said footballer. One third. And I think possibly your sound's off again.
I'm mouthing. 1995 and you were 14. Are you 10 years younger than me?
I didn't want to ask you because I thought it would be rude to ask a woman her age. But I did some calculations and I came to the conclusion that I was probably about 10 years younger than you. Yeah. Yeah.
And Paul, the oil of Ulay exacerbates the situation.
Ed has
a massive subscription. He pays about £200 a month for oil of Ulay. Yeah. In industrial amounts, it's splattered onto his face.
You've got to have a moisturising regime. Yeah, when you get into your 40s, you've got to have a moisturising regime. Lipton, look at young Lipton there. He's only about 25, and he doesn't realise that's the case.
I use goose fat off the Sunday lunch.
Oh no, well, black don't crack. That's the yeah.
Black people have thicker skin, literally. It's thicker.
Yeah, they don't get wrinkles.
What's the evolutionary advantage to having thicker skin?
You don't get upset as easily.
Oh, yeah. And they don't. And they don't. They're famously placid, unemotional people. If you ever see their funerals, it's stoical.
Well, I wrote an essay about black self-esteem advantage.
Yes, but no, it's not really an advantage, Paul. I don't want to cut you, but blacks need more humility and less self-esteem.
They do have, according to the book Why Race Matters by Michael Levin, there was a number of studies he brought together. They do have very high self-esteem.
Well, it's one of the most replicated findings in the last 60 years. Since after the civil rights.
They have too much self-esteem. They need some more humility.
They need to be humble like me and you and Paul and Paula. Yeah,
respect, innit?
Yeah, they need to.
Do you know what's so funny, Paula? Mm-hmm. There's a disconnect between self-esteem and autonomy. They're high in self-esteem, but they score low on measures of autonomy.
Do they?
You didn't do very well redirecting Lipton from this particular topic.
Yeah, Lipton, we've discussed.
He's taking his blanket off. He must be getting hot.
I'm deliberately not discussing all.
When he gets racist, he gets more and more excited, and the blanket comes off.
The blanket comes off. Yeah, like, obviously he's his heartbeat's going up, his body's getting hotter, he's becoming racist, and so obviously that's at that point the blanket comes off. But until that point, the blanket stays on. Now it's kind of half and half. He's like last week.
He's just teasing us now.
Last week he was
He's like a black Clint Eastwood at this point.
He was in full mode, and we had to take him down. We had to take down the video. Really, really, really.
Just be careful! My computer's going to crash again.
Oh, that is inevitable. Yeah, you must have some sort of virus or
I must have, because this is a 16 gigabyte new computer, so I must have picked up some horrible.
Paula, which late night offers did you nick it from, and can you get a better one next time?
Yeah,
obviously. Well,
cleaners perks.
I assume. Which late night office were you cleaning? Which office were you cleaning early in the morning?
I don't clean an office. I clean the local store.
Okay, and they happen to have a laptop mug about no, that you.
They don't have these kinds of things.
Some local workhouse boy has been looking at porn sites on, and of course you can't do that now in the UK, can you? You can't look at dodgy porn sites because you have to sign into them and give your ID. So all the kind of porn sites that are presumably going to give you viruses.
I can't even sign in to my kind of like women's self-writing kind of thing because it's got a smut. It's got a smut area on the thing, and it kind of won't let me in there. And I keep putting my face up to kind of because it says like put your face in the picture to make sure you're over 18, and then it just won't. I mean, obviously, it thinks I'm, you know, to you. No, it doesn't. It's just not working.
Right. We'll go back in a minute, but we're about halfway through, chaps. So hello. And welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. It's on Monday at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which discuss based science and the stuff going on in the news and generally having a bit of a laugh. But this is expunged from our woke joke universities. If you're new, will you please subscribe? Could you subscribe here on YouTube to the Jolly Heretic? And could you subscribe on my Substack? That's jollyheretic.com. Where I put all the most base stuff I can't put on YouTube, but in-person interviews, blogs, films I make, all kinds of stuff. And if you like what I do, you can support me for the cost of a pint of beer a month. Next to me, we have Mr. Lipton Matthews. Please subscribe to his channel. That is Lipton Matthews, where he has interviews with all kinds of interesting people. And he's also published a number of books on the old Amazon. So go and have a look at those. Below we have Paula Wright, our guest on the show today. So please, you can follow her on Twitter, Sexy Isn't Sexist. And what else can they subscribe to, Paula? Where can they support you?
Substack. My Substack is called Dysmemics, Bad Ideas That Harm Civilization. I'm going to change my X handle because this was an old one that was based on a stand-up I did a long time ago. And it doesn't really, it makes me look a bit feminist and I'm a kind of anti-feminist. So I need to get rid of that.
Is this this stand-up comedy, is this extant? Can we find it online?
I think they've taken it down. It was it was online, but I think they've taken it down now.
That's a bugger.
Yeah. I supported Simon Evans on his Genius tour in Newcastle, but that wasn't filmed either. That was just before COVID. So yeah.
So you were the warm-up act for Simon Evans.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he's also been down the Jolly Heretic Public House. Cool. And then finally we have Boomer Truth, sometimes Jerry Adams, sometimes Harold Shipman. It's mysterious, like a will-o'-the-wisp.
Rolf Shipman is my official name.
Rolf Harris, yeah, Rolf Shipman. But we also know him as Dr. Paul Taylor. And his channel is Readers of the Lost Art. So also go and subscribe there.
Can I just warn you, Ed, though? You need to warn your subscribers who a disproportionate number are quite anti-Semitic. I'm quite fond of old Judaic culture, and my channel references Judaic culture quite a lot, so that might put a lot of them off.
I think that the ones that are sort of superficially my followers, the in the world of cricket would be out far field. Like if we go back to my school metaphor, if you're crap at sport, cricket's great because you can just be a fielder and just stand.
I also had referred to quite a lot of books which might rule some of them out.
Yes, again, particularly the kind of people that will say whenever I publish a book, Ed, when's an audio version coming out? Hopefully never.
When's the one with pictures?
When's the one that I don't have to actually read? If it goes on like this,
I'll do it for you. I was a professional actress and did voiceovers. I'll do it for you. I'll do your thing.
Well, that's very kind of you, but I don't believe in it.
You might need to mime it for them.
Eddie, I want to speak to Paula, Ed. I want to speak to Paula.
Lipton, do you want to get a room? Lipton. Just leave me and Ed to one side. Paul, all right, if I was you, I'd be worried because Lipton's taste is normally along the lines of Anne Widdecombe.
Literally is Anne Widdecombe. Oh, by the way, did you know, Lipton, in my upstairs loo in my house, I have the... In my upstairs loo in my house, Lipton, I have the autobiography of Anne Widdecombe.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it's just sitting there on the.
I think Lipton has it in his toilet too.
I like the Anne Hegarty, who's on the is the big. I shouldn't say that big fat chaser. But yeah, we met each other a few years ago. That was good. She's great.
Is she based?
I think so. Yeah.
Never heard of her. I'll look into her. Right. Anyway, we have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn. And in the, I had had the idea of discussing more this Jamie Michael thing, but nobody seems interested. He's written the following poem. If you're planning on working with kids, your life could end up on the skids. An offhand remark that might well be dark is something that Starmer forbids. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. And if you, I'd like to thank him for that. And if you'd like to please buy Mr. Quinn's book of Jolly Heretic Poetry, which is available on the old Amazon, and it has a foreword by me. We've also had two super chats so far. The first is from Scat Milk, and he says, "Ed Dutton, come to Mare Fair 3. This is a formal invitation." All right, I'll write that down. These kinds of invitations keep happening to me. So I recently was emailed by the York University Reform Party Club and told that I am their honorary president.
Which university?
The University of York. Okay. And they told me, without consulting me as to whether I wanted to be the case, I am their honorary president, and for life, I assume. And whenever I'm in York, I mean, I was last in York in October 1991, so it could happen. But whenever I find myself in York, they would like me to come and speak. So that's why. If any other university reform associations would like to make me their honorary president, this is fine. but I will look into what Mare Fair 3 is. I don't know when I will next be in the UK, probably in the spring. Right, Stumbling says, we should not be calling them woke. It has positive connotations and sounds cuddly. We should call them what they are, anti-white. Yeah, that wouldn't have flown, though, would it? Because that would have...
It's too on the nose.
Sorry?
It's too on the nose.
It's too on the nose. It involves directly talking about race. And the kind of people like trigonometry that profit off being anti-woke do not like talking about race at all. No, really.
That's why they lauded the poor performance of Candy Andrews.
I think you should just call them Maoists, because there's lots of Maoist tendencies that they have.
You were on trigonometry, Paul.
Yes, ages ago.
It's true, but they're all feminists, basically.
Maoist.
They're still all feminine. No. Well, yes. But, I mean, a lot of where the intersectionality thing comes from.
Unisex dress code.
And they're all cucked men as well. They're all cuckolded, intellectually cuckolded men who won't say anything that will upset their women folk.
So I'm confused. I'm talking about Maoist. Historically, you're talking about modern woke.
I am. We're mixing, yeah.
Right, well, yeah, I thought cross purposes here.
I thought, Paula, you were talking about trigonometry.
I am.
Are they Maoist?
No, they're cooks. Yeah,
there seems to be an intellectual cuckold.
Is that a Maoist trying to say crooks?
Possibly.
It's a Geordie accent, Paul. You should be able to do it.
It's a Durham accent, actually, and it's not really strong.
It's not particularly strong.
No, pet.
Well, I don't know what they call the...
A few times.
Were you?
Yes.
I never, ever...
Catherine Cookson miniseries.
Paul, do you know Ed's real voice?
Catherine Cook did not write Biker Grove.
Why don't you do your real voice for Paula, which is basically East End Cockney, isn't it?
I can certainly do a
But that is your normal voice.
I can certainly do a passable South London voice, if that's what you want me to do, yeah.
I can do Ed's voice.
Go on, then.
Hello, 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 hello.
I sound like an effeminate Irishman.
Oh!
Paul, don't be so hard on yourself. You're
I was doing you, Ed. You're don't effem- deflect. Be at peace with your sexuality, Ed. Come on, Ed.
It's okay. Your ancestors have been in this country for 150 years, causing trouble. And a lot less than that, actually. I'm fully. Good God.
Are you Welsh?
My grandparents are Irish.
Before he was doing a Welsh accent.
I live in Wales.
All right.
I'm a colonialist.
I only know how to speak Welsh if I say Festinigogorin, really.
Clengiliogogogoch and all that stuff.
I don't know, but...
Ed, have you had a stroke? You look a bit confused.
Well, I saw there's a lot of information being
processed. I'm being serious. One side of your face has gone down a bit.
I haven't had a stroke recently. No. There was a lot of complicated stuff going on there, Welsh and Irish and stuff like this. I quite like going into the old London. It's a bit of effort though, because you have got to think about exactly how some words you get wrong and you don't pronounce them right. But obviously, if you're brought up around that kind of accent, it comes back to you very easily indeed. So yes.
So yeah, how did you develop the "I'm so far back I could be up the Queen's backside" English accent?
But you really want the conversation about it, genuinely? I think what happened.
I'm curious of why you've got an affected accent. That's all.
It's not affected. It's the accent I was taught, as my father used to speak. Basically, I think in this accent, and I learned that my uncle Mike had that accent. His brother John had that accent. They had this exact accent that I'm using, and I think that I was always then encouraged to speak like this by my parents. Oh, you sound so grown up. Oh, you're speaking properly or whatever. So when I went to school, what I should have done, obviously, is drop this accent and just take on the local accent that all of the children were talking with. But I just didn't do that. So no, I've always had this accent. I've recorded on me at 8 with this accent. Sorry?
I can testify to that because my son is... he's been brought up in the Northeast and he speaks more like... me, where everybody else in the village speaks much more of a broader dialect.
Yeah, Paula, but you're not. I mean this in the nicest possible way. You are accented.
Yeah, I am. But
yeah, it's not like your son grew up to talk
accented,
in a.
I'm not dialected.
Yeah. But it's not like your son grew up and talking in a demented fashion like Ed. So it's no, it's not that serious.
There was a study, I think, about in maybe 94, and I think the lead author was Simon Baron Cohen, actually. And it looked at the association between autistic traits and accents. And one of the things it found is that autistic kids are much more likely to maintain their parental accent and not to adopt the local accent of where they
autistic? Have
them. I've not been diagnosed as it, but jokes are often made.
That's the most... Paul, that's the most redundant diagnosis ever.
There is something like that. It's like kind of like when I was growing up, I kind of affected an accent a bit like yours, just to separate myself from the community that were pushing me out anyway. And it was kind of all right. So you're saying weird.
What's even weirder is that for the first 10 years of his life, Lipton had a home counties accent.
It's true, and he's affected this. He's affected this this, and he's also undergone a complete whitendectomy. I mean, you know, actually, he's from Hertfordshire, and he's an Englishman, but he's put a great like Michael Jackson in reverse. He's put a great deal. There she goes again.
Paul has stropped off.
Put a great deal of effort into being this black and Jamaican. whereas in reality,
people used to think that I was a white man pretending to be black before they saw my face.
So they thought you were adopting a Jamaican accent, just sort of like
they didn't. They were not listening to me. They were just reading my pieces, so they assumed that I was a white man pretending to be black.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, because people couldn't
believe it.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they'd read his stuff and they'd assume he was a white man that was writing it, but that was saying at the end, "Oh, I'm Jamaican" or whatever.
Yeah, an old white man.
Yeah. Well, when
Lipton, you know why I knew you were black? Because I heard you. I heard you fancied Anne Widdecombe.
Ed wants to speak.
No, I know. I was just going to say that they were really, really shocked when they discovered that Charlotte Bronte was a woman. interestingly, they were less shocked when they discovered that Emily Bronte was a woman. But for some reason, with Charlotte Bronte, they concluded, no, this is a man. It's clearly a man who's writing this. Even though it's written through the eye of the story, isn't it? It's written through the eye of Jane Eyre. It's Jane Eyre telling you, I did this. Even though everyone thought that it was a man, it must have been a man that had written it. Mainly, they argued because it was so good. Whereas, even though Emily Wuthering Heights is much more kind of violent and with
yeah, but it's bad violence. It's really unrealistic. So at one point, Heathcliff smashes his head into the granite stone with hobnailed boots, and he gets up perfectly fine. You know, 3 minutes later, only a woman could write violence that badly.
I see. I've not read it. I have to confess, I've read Jane Eyre.
No, it's a beautifully written book, don't get me wrong, but the violence, that particular aspect, is a giveaway that it wasn't written by a man.
I suppose so. I mean, they were completely
mental. I read it a long time ago, and I always thought, why didn't it end? It kind of has two parts, and I was really disappointed by the second half. You get all
the... Well, it's very accurate, because I think Heathcliff probably came from Liverpool. He was found on the streets of Liverpool, and he's a kleptomaniac psychopath. So psychologically, it's very accurate.
Yeah.
It's also very accurate in, as far as I can see, Kathy has probably got something like borderline personality disorder or post-traumatic stress. And so she'd be attracted from the literature to a complete psychopath just like that. And she is. I mean, she's basically a masochist as well. And that crosses over with borderline personality disorder. And I think she's BPD. I'm writing a book on this at the moment, as it happens.
Book title, then?
I haven't come up with the title yet, but I'm 35,000 words in.
What's it about then?
It's about the influence of women with cluster B disorders on everything, particularly history. So, but I haven't come up with a title yet. But basically, I've been looking into the biographies of like, the women that are ranked by Charles Murray.
Cluster biatch.
Oh, that's good. Cluster bitch.
Biatch, pronounce cluster, it properly.
No one will get that. That's too recondite. Cluster bitches.
I deliberately didn't say that because I'm thinking I want to protect Ed's brand. And what does Ed do? Start shouting the B word.
That's not the B word. No one ever said that was the B. Although somebody, I was once at a fundamentalist Christian meeting and they were quoting, you know that bit where, what's that guy?
That's that Beelzebub.
Kenneth Williams. No, bloody. Kenneth Williams. And they talked about how he didn't believe in God. He was an atheist, so he killed himself. And in the diary that he writes, oh, what's the bloody point? And this evangelical speaker quoted this, but wrote, oh, what's the B point? He even the word bloody in that context of competitive purity signalling is too rude to like the mildest swear word there can possibly be.
If you're Christian, again, it's just the sad decline of our society. You're now downgrading an anti-Christian swear word. Shame on you, Ed.
Oh, come on. What, you think he really knew that its etymology is by my lady? Is that what you're saying?
Well, isn't there also God's blood? Or God, that was one of the origins. I think it's got more than one potential origin.
I didn't know about the God's blood one. I just thought that was God's blood. But I know they said that it's in Chaucer. But and interestingly, in Chaucer he didn't. In Chaucer they swear. In Chaucer, it's the Victorian period.
Ye al gat in it went, is from the Merchant's Tale.
Ye shall have quentenach of either. That's from the Wild Bath Tale. Lipton, do you want to do a quote from Shakespeare or Chaucer?
No, I like Winston Churchill. When I was in Jamaica, I used to quote him everywhere, and every night when I went to club meetings. A social club.
What kind of a club?
A social club. Yeah, so whenever we had the icebreaker, I would go up and I would quote Sir Winston Churchill.
Okay, Paul, you were going to do some Shakespeare quotes.
No, I can't. I said I can't do.
Oh, yeah. Well, blow wind, crack thy cheeks, thy hurricane. Yeah,
my favourite one for these days is open your ears, for which of you would stop the vent of hearing when loud rumour speaks, which is basically... social media. Shakespeare talked about social media and how a lie goes around the world.
My favourite Shakespeare quote is, "I'd rather be a toad." It's from Othello.
We had a teacher at school called that?
It's "I'd rather be a toad and live in the corner of a dank dungeon or something." I'm forgetting it.
Which character says it? It's not Othello, is
it? I thought it was Othello, because he'd rather be a toad than share a corner of the thing I love is one of the lines.
Emily Bronte once told a pupil that she has more love for a random dog than she does any of the pupils in this classroom. She was a bitch. She was a biatch. She was a very unpleasant woman, by all accounts, and particularly the account of her sister Charlotte. She was just awful. But anyway, enough of her. And then Anne Bronte, I don't know what that was about. Crazy bitch, died about 28.
Sorry, Ed. Someone told me not to interrupt you in the comments, so I won't.
Who told you that?
Christopher Peter Goodman, I think. Okay, I think he's talking about me. If he is, scrub your nan. I'll keep doing it. Go on, Ed.
I don't know. I don't know why I'm on that topic. We need to get back to the meat of the situation. Anyway, where was I? Yes. So we have right wing people. We're trying to get onto a serious topic here, Paul. Remember, serious stuff.
Paul has distracted us all. Paul keeps taking us down weird alleyways.
She does.
Paul, every week we are so on topic all the time, and look what you've done.
You have taken us off topic. Yeah, I don't know.
I apologize to Christopher. Christopher was actually talking about Paula. So apologies, Christopher. And Paula, stop interrupting Ed.
I didn't know that Paula interrupted me. The other thing that's happened, that we're talking about, let me finish my point about sports day, which we're so off. That was what I'm saying.
Paula just swore at you silently, Ed.
I always found it ridiculous.
Don't ignore her. She's swearing at you.
Let me finish my point, please. That the yobby kids, okay, that do nothing for the school, right? That we kids that hate sport, we work hard and get good A-level results and go to good universities and whatever, do things the school wants you to do and behave ourselves as well. And they mess around misbehaving and fighting and stuff. And they get rewarded once a year with sports day. Literally rewarded with a day dedicated to the only subject they like. And we get punished with a day dedicated to the only subjects we don't like. Well, woodwork. I always thought that was just deeply and gravely unfair.
Do you know what's unfair? What?
Did you do woodwork?
Yes.
Yeah, state school. So we did.
That was
the
remedial class, wasn't it?
Eh?
Wasn't that a remedial class?
Yes, no. Paula. Why are you surprised we're talking about Ed?
Yeah. It was actually.
I wanted to do woodwork.
It was compulsory right up to GCSE. Woodwork and metalwork.
If you went to a shit school.
I have GCSE grade B in woodwork and metalwork.
Do you know what's funny, Ed? A white person in England. That's really funny. Do you know why it's funny? Because you work really hard. Listen. You work really hard. You pay taxes. And not your children. You have your grandchildren, right? And you expect your grandchildren to get a good life because you work so hard. But whenever they go online to search for opportunities, all the programs are not for them.
This is true. They're not for them. Although I would dispute the working really hard thing. I don't know where you get this idea that they say in the house, hardworking parents, loving parents, all this sort of thing. Well, that's just highly manipulative nonsense, isn't it? The majority of people, surely, if the economics of England and most countries tells anything, the majority of people are not hardworking. They're not hard work, but they can't be, because hard working is a quality that can only exist if the average person doesn't work hard. So almost by definition, parents, families are not hard working. Some families are hard working. Most, I would say, the majority are not hard working. They're not.
But didn't we have an empire so we wouldn't have to work hard? Have I missed something?
Yeah, was that not the point of it? That we haven't we gradually got to a situation as we've industrialized and so on, that we work a lot less hard than we used to? Isn't that a good thing? Shouldn't the pursuit be to work, to do less, to just to be like the lotus eaters?
Oh, brilliant point, Ed. That's so brilliant. Rich countries are more productive than poor countries. So poor countries work longer hours. So I was online recently. I don't like Reddit, but somebody posted one of, well, I don't like Reddit, but some of my pieces are on Reddit. Somebody put one of the pieces on Reddit. And I was on Reddit recently, the Jamaican Reddit. And somebody said, Jamaicans in North America, they work the longest. The Caribbean is in North America. So when you look at countries in the North American continent, the Jamaicans, they work the longest. And I said, obviously, Jamaica is a low productivity country. So that's why they work longer hours than other countries, because they're low productivity. So that's not an achievement if you work long hours.
Yeah, but I would think the Japanese work long hours. And
the Japanese work long hours, but they're
incredibly unproductive.
The Japanese are unproductive because they're overworked. So in Japan, people are emotionally invested in work. And if the employee is incompetent, instead of dismissing the employee, they will put him into that little room, purgatory. So the Japanese, they just work for working's sake, so they become unproductive. So right, in the so OC, they work too much. They work without passion or energy. So they're just working really hard to conform, and it becomes a waste.
Right, so the optimum then is an optimum level of work, like an optimum, which we really should calculate what it is, and then do that.
Yeah,
that's obvious.
Well, but it's also self-fulfilling. So, for example, let's say I had to mark 100 papers. I could work really, really fast, mark 20 very quickly, and then inevitably you just need a break. You go wandering off for an hour, you come back, and you might as well have done the same number more slowly. There's a certain speed of working that's efficient. And you can try and take shortcuts, but they're not really shortcuts in the long run.
No, this is true.
Most jobs have their natural pace.
Yeah, they do have their natural pace. But then the argument is that of late, like the world is faster and it's sped up and people are under more pressure and whatever. But I don't see that necessarily follows.
That makes sense, because I retired really early because I thought the world had speeded up. So I went along with it.
So you're going to die early as well? Is that your plan?
No.
So you're just going to have a substantial amount of leisure time before you die.
Ridiculous amounts, yeah.
Yeah, that's
the idea, isn't it? Shouldn't it be for retirement?
Yeah. Well, or at the very least, then
retirement's wasted on the old.
It is. They should work when they're old. They should work when they're old. And when you're young and you have energy, you should be retired and you can do all kinds of things. But I suppose it's a question also of you actually enjoy your work. So I, most of the time, enjoy the means via which I generate income. And always have done in the various jobs I've done. And the various, off she goes. And the exception to that was the only time I really did a proper job, like a proper job, and that was working for the Royal Bank of Scotland in an office for 8 weeks, and that was awful. It was awful. And it was just so, it was so soul-destroyingly boring. And the worst thing is that you had to kind of make it look like you had something to do, whereas you most had a couple of hours work a day. And that was what, you know, people, we talked before about the British office, and how it gets that right. It understands that most people that are doing it are like Tim, and they're just doing it because they just need money and they've made bad life decisions, like dropping out of university, as Tim did. And what I cannot get my head around is the enthusiasm, it's the opposite of the office, the enthusiasm for work and for their job among the characters in the American office. That can only be American aspirational. We all enjoy our lives. It's a very boring job. And in their job, they have to get bonuses as well. So it's not even that secure. Do not understand that. What's the most boring job you've ever done, Paula? What's the most unfulfilling job you've ever done that you've hated?
Oh, God. I've done a lot of jobs. Like worked in the service industry. Temped a lot in admin. Probably just... being paid to fill envelopes with letters all day.
These weren't like anything exciting. These weren't like letter bombs.
Yeah. Well, yes. I didn't even look at them. It was just kind of like, oh, we need. They have a big thing that's going out to lots of people. This is in the time when, you know, before emails.
Before internet. That's the thing. Now, if you do a boring job, you can just sit there on your phone on the internet all day.
Yeah.
Ed, you know, when you worked for 5 years in the horse fertility clinic, were you bored?
In the horse fertility clinic?
Yes.
Wanking off horses for cold, hard cash.
I never said that, but thank you for sharing.
No, I'm afraid I didn't. I didn't do that. I suppose at least working with animals could be quite.
That's where you got your equine elbow from.
Is there such a thing as equine elbow?
Yes, you got it in the horse fertility clinic.
Like
people.
Tennis elbow.
I did, indeed. Yeah. Yes, Lipton, have you ever done a very boring job?
Me?
Yes, you.
It all depends on what you consider to be boring. The job itself might be boring, but the people are always very Jamaican.
In Jamaica, that's a given, isn't it?
Yes, there's always some story. Like, I remember once, I don't really like to talk about private issues in public, but I remember once I had this really crazy co-worker. Yeah, she was crazy. Let me tell you what she did. So, she had a problem. She had this supervisor who was really gossipy, and I would speak to the supervisor. So because of that, she became upset that I was speaking to the supervisor. She assumed that I was talking about her with the supervisor, and I said no. But I didn't really care much for her. I was just tolerating her. I'm polite. But yeah, she became really infuriated, and which she said things like, we used to be close. No, we weren't. I was just being polite. And like one, she said to me that even if she's not physically attracted to me. This was before she became angry. She said, even if she's not physically attracted to me, she would sleep with me because she likes my brain. So whatever.
So basically, what you're saying is a woman who I assume is a bit older than you really, really fancied you. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, me. Yeah.
That's your boring job, is it? Paula.
I've remembered a most boring job I ever had, and I turned it, and it was an acting job. And we went to the rehearsals and they said, we're going to do this thing. I can't remember what it was, but we have to drive for 3 hours there and back. And my core person was so boring. I rang my agent and said, I'm sorry, I can't spend 3 hours in the car with this person. So he was just absolutely the most really good looking, but could only talk about his bad back all the time. And I just thought about being stuck in a car with him down the motorway 3 hours there and 3 hours back. And I just don't know.
What was it. Yeah, that sort of partridge moment. Would it be really rude to stop talking to you and go and talk to somebody else? it is a problem. I should look more into the psychology of boringness, of being boring.
Well, there's a brilliant book on the philosophy, well, not the philosophy, but the pros and cons of being bored.
Oh yes,
that's well developed literature. BBC Future used to feature articles on the psychology of boredom.
There was that famous book from the early 1800s about being bored. I'm sure there was, and the ways of not becoming melancholic and making the best of being bored. I forget the name of it.
I just can't spend time with people who are constantly complaining. That's more draining than anything.
I'm surprised you're on this show, then.
I mean, Paul is known as a bit of a joyless moaner, so I should have warned you about that. But the draining, I suppose, is making. I've experienced it. There must be something on the call. I was at a table at the London Conference on Intelligence in Budapest years ago, and I was aware that I was the most sort of extrovert person at the table. And I don't like that because it means that I'm making all the effort and other people are enjoying my, you know, my raconteurship and jokes. And I'm making all the effort and other people can make the bloody effort. So in the end, I moved tables. I just thought this is unacceptable that everybody on this table is boring. And that's not fair. Why should I be put on a table where everyone is poor? It's quite insulting, actually, I felt, that I've been put on that table. They must have known. It's one of those things where you put, they have the name and the place and whatever.
Are you reading my mind, Ed?
And the organizer,
just thinking of the last 80 minutes.
Oh, come on. You've enjoyed yourself. You've laughed out loud. You've had tremendous fun. We haven't. You enjoy. Although we have steered off intellectual topics for most of the time. I don't quite know how we've done it. We should come up with an intellectual topic next week and stick with it, and dissect it in real turgid detail. But the problem is, if you do that, it's never funny. You don't have the banter if you really really go into it. That's the problem. So I don't know. I'm on the horns of a dilemma on that regard. But I do.
You're addicted, aren't you, Ed? You're addicted to the bants.
Yeah. I like that. Well, you know, you have friends, don't you? That you have a
I don't know, but go on.
No, obviously you don't. But you're like Charlotte Bronte or Emily Bronte. You don't have friends outside of your family.
No, waste of time.
You just have your own little fantasy world called the glass.
He has clients.
Yeah,
I have people in the basement.
He has, yeah. He collects young women.
I call them a Fritzel friend.
Yeah. He does. And he gives them pizza under the door because it fits. It can't have two.
You can only have two. It's a two-topping door gap. So you don't spoil them. You don't have a gap that gives them three toppings. Two toppings just fit.
Yeah, it's not like one of those Pizza Hut ones where they have cheese in the crust, where it's a big crust. It's got to be quite thin. To get under the door, yeah, that's what he does. God, I forgot what I was going to say. You see how this happens? But you have some people that you have one thing in common, the thing that you're friends about. You're friends about, going jogging, going parkour, going whatever. And beyond that, you have absolutely nothing to talk about. And then you have, and so are your friends in the circumstances? Why are we friends? Oh, we're at university together, doing the same degree. And then they don't last very long, and then that's most friends, isn't it? That's most people.
It's most marriages.
Because you have the child in common, you have the working on the child in common. Yeah, I would imagine that the divorce rate is certainly elevated once the child moves out, isn't it?
Hmm.
Well, that's seven-year itch, isn't it?
Empty nest syndrome.
7-year itch. Well, that implies the relationship lasts for 7 years, and then you start to think.
That's tertiary syphilis.
What were you saying,
Paula? I think that's the kind of the pattern in hunter gatherers, isn't it? It's kind of they are serial monogamous, and they have. I think the divorce, because they don't have official divorces, is about 50% in hunter gatherers, and it as it is in Western societies. It's kind of started to kind of represent the choice. If you have the choice, unless you're very lucky and you meet, you know, your soulmate and stuff, you tend to kind of have one relationship, and then when the kids grow up and can look after themselves, get past that critical time from infant and child mortality, then you get a bit bored and you get a new partner. And
That's interesting. Yeah. So we're not enforcing this lifetime monogamy, and so therefore it must go.
Well, that just seems to be what's happening. It seems to be kind of regressing back to what you see in hunter gatherers, who are egalitarian but are not enforcing. They have pair bonds. They have exclusive pair bonds, but they're not lifelong. On average, some of them are, if you're lucky.
This is my understanding. I forget whether it was the Bushmen or the Pygmies among whom this research was done. Which?
I think it was the Bushmen. The Pygmies are different. Yeah.
Yeah. The Bushmen. That's right. And it was. The Khoisan. Yeah. But they practice polygamy though.
Oh, did they? Well, was it?
No, but they all prehistoric societies practice polygamy. So this idea of a monogamous but temporary pair bond.
It's called serial monogamy.
Yeah, but I'd have to look that up, because my understanding is that these societies mainly practice polygamy. So among the lower status people in the society, they only have one partner, and that lasts 7 years. That would make more sense, because it would be the high status men that would have multiple wives. So maybe that's it. What do you think, Lipton? Are you familiar with the literature on this?
a serial literal onward. See, polygamy in inspired societies.
Serial monogamy, that you have a relationship but it lasts 10 years or so and then you have another one.
A little, but not deeply. But I've heard the term before.
I wrote a paper out a while ago on basement bigamy.
Well, yes, you can't be expected to be loyal to them when there's so many of them all under this. But there's bound to be a trauma bond that's created. There's bound to be Stockholm syndrome. They're all going to love you. I mean, they're all going to love you because their lives are in your hands, ironically. So I think this is certainly true. But yeah, we are moving back to type. I suppose we are also moving back to polygamy in the sense that you get. If this sort of the kind of stuff that these incels go on about, I don't know how true it is, that the hookup culture of whatever this app is that everyone uses, what's it called?
Tinder, I don't know.
Yeah, Tinder, that's the one. The small number of men get all the attention, and so those men get multiple partners, and then everyone else gets nothing, and so that's really a reversion back to the polygamy of prehistory. God, what's that noise? Sorry, chaps. There's some technical stuff going on here. A lot of technical stuff going on. But yeah, we would be reverting back to that. Yes. So I'm more. I don't know if she's coming back. I don't know if it's gone now. If Paula is it was continual during my interview with her, the one I recorded just kept crashing. And it's a bit of a problem because it means that the conversation can't flow as easily.
Is it because the Northeast is much less developed than the rest of the country?
I don't know. I haven't really ever. I don't know what it is, but it's just bad internet, isn't it? But I mean, it's just bad computer. It just keeps collapsing. I don't know. I didn't really use the internet when I lived in the Northeast. And when I lived in the Northeast, it was only in its infancy anyway. They couldn't do complicated things like this. So
they use cans on string from what I've seen.
Cans on string or just shouting. Just
were a pet.
A flower. Loudly. Yeah, like flower. That's what they'd say. And you just do that. That was it. That was all you do. And the idea that now they have to use computers and internets and ethernets, whatever that is, and all this kind of complicated stuff I don't know if she lives quite rurally, but this is even when I had Survived the Jive on years ago, his internet was so bad, it was so poor, and he was in rural Devon or somewhere like that. But you're quite rural though, Paul.
Yeah, but ironically, it's got super fast internet because it was some like pioneering area.
That's what I found about Moldova. Everything was awful, basically, except the internet. Mm. And the internet's brilliant. The internet's super fast. The internet's everywhere. The internet's practically free. You know, they're very, very internet. But things like fixing the roads or whatever was absolutely impossible. How's the internet in Jamaica, Lipton?
Well, it's okay. Like where in my community, it's okay. It's not bad.
It's not bad. Is there a problem with the internet in the Northeast?
No, I'm on Ethernet, so it's plugged in. It's the computer. I've tried it on different browsers, so this is on Chrome now.
You know what you're getting for Christmas, Paula.
I'm not. I wish.
Well, are you going to buy Paula a functioning computer for Christmas?
No, you should if you're going to have her as a guest. Otherwise, you're just exploiting her labour. You capitalist pig.
There is 1,600 people watching this, and these
well, they should all chip in and buy Paula a computer.
It just crashes. I've done it in. Ooh, what's that one? Done it in Firefox. Done it in Microsoft Edge. This is Chrome. I've got AVG.
Yeah. I don't know what that means, but it's
an antivirus malware thing. It doesn't say that there's anything wrong.
Okay, no. Well, I would like to thank Paula for coming on, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in, and it's been good fun, and we will see you all. God, moving towards Christmas, chaps. So we should do some Christmas. Just do a Christmas. God, will next week be the one nearest to Christmas? Good God, I don't know. But we'll have to do a Christmas one. But anyway, thank you, everybody, and see you all soon, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yes. We're finished now.
Goodbye.